by shifting cataracts of fog. They passed through a lamplit living room, a shadowy dining room, and into a kitchen. Beyond the open kitchen lay a family room, and in the family room stood a six-sided table designed for card games, and on the table were a few plates of canapes, and in the chairs were three women and three men. They were enjoying a pre-dinner game of cards, their conversation animated, their attention fixed largely on the hands they had been dealt and on the discard that the current player was making. Ashima was the first to realize that the gods in the raiments of judgment had arrived, and she stared open-mouthed, too shocked to scream. Indeed, in the few seconds before the gunfire began, there were no screams from any of the six, only gasps of surprise and throttled pleas. Only three of the six managed to push up from their chairs in the little time that fate had allotted them, though they had no chance to flee or fight. To Alecto, Ashima was not her mother's sister, because her mother was Gia, and it was not a Fury's role to grant mercy. Nor were there words, or need of words, only the voices of the pistols roaring point-blank. A brightly colored dress of silk flared like the wings of an exotic parrot before an attempt at flight failed, and the dazzling silk furled around the fallen form of the broken would-be flyer. Figures in desperate postures, each concerned only for himself, gesturing antically. Grotesque expressions, perhaps common in the subterranean streets of Pandemonium. Those who stood then at once fell into those who remained seated, or they collapsed back into their chairs. The six-sided table shuddered, and the cards slithered onto the floor, fanning out arrangements of numbers and royal images that perhaps a gypsy might have read to ascertain the ultimate destination of the hosts and their four guests. Start to finish, the judgment lasted less than a minute, and when it was finished, there was no time to survey the aftermath, let alone to dwell upon it or to wonder what it meant. Anyway, it was nothing. It meant nothing. Besides, there was more to be done, and in as timely a fashion as possible. 21. A darkness arises around the perimeter of the kitchen, not a failure of the light, but a gathering of shapes that remind Booth Hendrickson of large birds, although he can't discern any of their features. They are shadows, where nothing exists to cast them. The voice of his interrogator comes and goes. Sometimes he answers her, sometimes not. As the shadows congregate at the edges of his vision, hope retreats through the intricate spirals of his mind, and despair advances. There was a time long ago when he was alone in the dark, but not afraid. Alone in the dark with nobody to see, when, like the boy in the books, he would say aloud, "I think to myself, I play to myself, and nobody knows what I say to myself." But that is not the darkness to which he is now returning, as the control mechanism weaves its web across his brain. The darkness coming will have no play in it, no delight, and no thought of his can ever be kept secret from those who command him in his servitude. The coming darkness is that found in deep places, down where the crooked staircase leads, where the steps slope horizontal as well as strictly vertical, a nautilus of stairs, a maze, serving rooms where you must feel your way blindly because you have not earned a light to carry. He has been there before, long ago, humbled to the condition of a beaten dog. He knows the misery of servitude, of being absolutely powerless. He would rather die than return to enslavement, but he is restrained at this kitchen table with no means of killing himself. And once the web's radials and spirals map the contours of his brain, he will be able to take his life only if ordered to do so. He knows the truth of the world. He has been taught. There is no escaping the cold truth of the world. Rule or be ruled. Use or be used. Break others or be broken by them. In every case, His only remaining option is the oar. The rising darkness rises farther, reaching the summit of the walls, spreading to the ceiling from which shapen shadows depend like black cocoons, encroaching on the table at which he sits. The only light in all the world is that surrounding the table, and the source of the light is she who rules him. She is clothed in light, and her face is luminous, and her eyes are blue fire as she poses her questions. "Where are you, Booth? Are you still here with me? Do you hear me, Booth Hendrickson? Can you hear me? Where are you, Booth?" He is in despair. That is where he is. It is a despair so pure that it will never evolve into desperation, which is energized and reckless despair, for he is without energy, drained. "Where are you, Booth?" For fear that she will take away her precious light and leave him enswarmed by darkness, he answers her. To his surprise, Booth speaks about that of which he must never speak. He tells her where he is, or rather where he has been, and where he foresees himself.
"The crooked staircase."
Once the words have been spoken, the spell of silence is broken, and what was forbidden to be expressed is suddenly expressible. 22. What had happened was nothing. It meant nothing. Nothing at all. The still, small voice within assured her of that. Those in this house who had appeared to be people were not, in fact, people. The earth was a stage, those on it merely characters guided by a script. These people's story was no more important than any other, which is to say, not important at all. Mere entertainment for the gods. What transpired next was nothing more than stagecraft. Alecto had been a minor divinity in ancient Rome as well as in ancient Greece, but her rank didn't mean that she was colorless. By their nature, the Furies were colorful, agents of retribution, marked by flaunt and flourish, shine and swagger, and it was incumbent upon anyone who would write about Alecto, who would become a vessel for Alecto, for the Chandi aspect of Kali, for others of their dark divinity, to uphold the sacred tradition of flamboyance. Tanuja stood on the stoop, waiting, the front door open wide behind her. The cul-de-sac was quiet in the night and muffling fog. At the only other house that contained light, luminous windows seemed not part of any structure, seemed to float in the mist like large video screens made of some lighter-than-air material, none of them tuned to a channel, offering no drama, as if none could compete with events occurring in the Chatterjee house. There were no shadowy forms of alarmed residents at those windows, no sirens in the distance. Most likely, the brief burst of gunfire had not traveled through walls, through night, through fog, through other walls. But it was not unlikely that even if the sound carried, those near enough to hear it were lost in a video game or binge-watching whatever, or were seeing out Saturday with a joint of good weed, having traded reality for one virtual reality or another. The scripts of their stories did not require them to hear. Through the lamplight and the darkness and a thickening sea of fog, Sanjay returned with the coiled orange extension cord and the reciprocating saw. He was tall, trim, all in black. For a moment, a sharp fear pierced Tanuja, a terror of Sanjay. But this was only her little brother, her twin, blood of her blood, and the fear at once quieted away. They did not speak when he arrived at the stoop and followed her into the house, for there was nothing that needed to be said. There was merely stagecraft to perform, set decoration, steps to be taken, always one step at a time, never knowing what was next until it needed to be done, according to the script by which they lived. For a while, as they worked, Tanuja thought of Subhadra in the form of the unfinished novelette, of the beauty of falling rain in silver skeins and the splendor of lightning, born from a cumulonimbus womb, of the majesty of thunder like the rumble of colossal wheels moving creation along mysterious tracks. When the six severed heads were placed at intervals along the walkway leading to the front door, sister and brother stepped out of the night into the foyer, she with her back turned to one mirror, he with his back to the other. They stood face to face, an arm's length apart. Cool fog slithered through the open door, drawn by the warmth of the house. Sanjay wept quiet tears. She asked him why, and he didn't know why. She said affectionately, "Choti bai, little brother." He said, "Benji," and his tears flowed faster. She said, "Peripona," which meant, "I touch your feet," though she did not stoop to touch them, for he already knew how profoundly she cherished him. His reply, "Peripona," brought tears to her eyes. Not quite sure why she said it, she said, "Every story must have an end. That is the way of stories." Because it was what his script instructed him to say, Sanjay replied, "I will count to three." He counted, in perfect cadence, precisely 2 seconds between the numbers, no hesitation because of doubt or confusion or emotion, for their actions must be perfectly simultaneous in this, which was their last moment on the stage. His eyes on hers, her eyes on his, his pistol pressed to her head, hers to his. They never heard the co-eternal shots that ended their lives, though the sound of a single but double-loud blast carried through the open door and along the front walkway and into the cul-de-sac, drawing the attention of a neighbor who had just stepped out to walk his dog, then the police, then the news media, and then the world in all its ignorance. 23. In the green night, there were natural roads through the dense scrub, carved by the ways of water and wind, navigable slopes of gravelstone, barren ridgelines that could be followed for a while. Even in this inhospitable territory, in some canyons enough water lay beneath the surface to slake the thirst of eucalyptus and California buckeye. Some places there were immense live oaks, too, that sprawled into tortured architectures, shaped by acidic soil and heat and insect pests that didn't allow more natural forms, never forests of them, but transfigured groves through which the Land Rover passed, as if journeying across a post-apocalyptic landscape. Gavin knew some of this territory from years of riding horses here, although he could not possibly be familiar with all of the hundreds of square miles ahead, and in this peculiar citrine light, he was unable to recognize even some familiar landmarks. In addition to experience and instinct, however, he was relying on a battery-illumined large-faced compass that he had fixed to the console between him and Jesse. Although he'd had no expectation of making good time in these conditions, he worried that they were not putting the miles behind them fast enough. More than 8 years from his last battlefield, he began to feel a familiar itch between the shoulder blades, a queasiness in the gut, and a tightening of the scrotum that were his instinct warning of trouble ahead. In the cargo area behind the back seat, the dogs had been lying down, as they mostly did when traveling in any vehicle other than the apple-green 48 Ford pickup, wherein they liked to sit or even stand, leashed and anchored for their safety, to sightsee and let the wind blow through their fur. Now, as the Rover was cruising through a meadow of low scraggly grass veined with taller coastal sage, Duke and Queenie scrambled to their feet and began to growl low in their throats. From the back seat, Travis said, "They sure don't like something on your side of the Rover, Uncle Gavin." Although traveling 5 miles an hour in respect of the sudden changes the terrain could undergo, Gavin slowed further to scan the night through his side window. At first, he saw nothing. Then, the pack raced into view. "Coyotes," he said. "Six of them. a large pack for a species that often hunted alone. They were lean and shadowy green shapes with bright green eyes. Their serrated smiles were the palest green in this macabre vision.
I can see them, sort of, Travis said. They've got fire in their eyes.
Gavin slowed further to let the beasts race ahead, but the coyotes slowed as well and hung with the rover.
To them, said Travis, we're like some kind of canned meat.
Jesse laughed.
Delivered to their door, just like pizza.
The dogs' low growls were punctuated with thin, keening sounds, almost whimpers. They were ready to fight. But at the same time, they acknowledged the greater ferocity of these wild creatures that, for all they might share with shepherds genetically, would go for the dogs' throats as savagely as if Duke and Queenie were rabbits. Like the dogs, Gavin saw nothing amusing about being stalked by six long-toothed prairie wolves. They might be safe in this can on wheels, but they couldn't stay in the vehicle forever if it blew a tire. 24. On his way to becoming adjusted, Booth Hendrickson had fallen apart. When the nanoweb finished spinning itself, it would control a human form that looked like the once dreaded man from the DOJ, and it would be powered by the electrical currents of that functioning brain. But the man would not be who he once was, and the brain would be a repository for a mind in which long-tied psychological knots had come undone, and a profound unraveling had occurred. As he told Jane and Gilberto about the Tahoe estate and the crooked staircase, he did so in a discursive monologue, now and then bordering on incoherent. There was no way to keep him focused on the most salient facts by interrogating him, for he reacted to what she asked as if he were the ball in a pinball field, ricocheting off the question in unanticipated directions. The more questions that were put to him, the more fractured his narrative became, so that there was nothing to be done but let him talk, listen, and slowly make sense of all the puzzle pieces. The story that he told of childhood abuse was so extreme, so unlike anything Jane had ever heard, that she expected him to become emotional, to weep with self-pity and shake with rage. Apparently, however, his capacity for emotion had been diminished for a long time. As an adolescent and adult, what he had been able to feel seemed to have been related to his conviction of superiority, to a deeply instilled sense of being one of a class above all others. He felt contempt for the masses in general, and for most individuals in particular, disgust at what he imagined to be their universal ignorance, abhorrence at their pretensions to equality, hatred of them for their claims to such feelings as love, faith, compassion, and sympathy, all of which he knew to be fictions by which they hid from themselves the truth of the world. And he had known fear as well, fear of those billions who were beneath him and who, by their stupidity and ignorance and reckless behavior, might destroy the world, not just for themselves, but for him and those exalted people like him. Of nobler emotions, he seemed to have long been bereft. Now, in the telling of his experiences with the crooked staircase, even the ignoble emotions seemed inaccessible to him, leaving him only with fear, and in fact, with just a single fear. He rambled through his story in a monotone, recalling the most hideous details with no more emotion than a mathematician reading off pages of the calculations he used to solve a problem. But from time to time he looked at Jane with sudden fright and said, "Tell me you won't take the light away. Please, please, don't take the light away." When his story wound to its tangled end, he sat in silence, hands in his lap, head bowed, form without substance, a hollow man, his headpiece stuffed with straw. An hour earlier, Jane would have thought she could never pity this ruthless user of others. If she pitied him now, she did not go so far as to have sympathy with him, for that would be to confer upon him a dignity he didn't deserve. When he looked at her and pleaded for light. His expression was one of abject submission, with a suggestion of veneration, as if he held her in exalted honor and didn't fear her at all, but reserved his fright for the loss of light, for being left in darkness, as he had been left within the place that he called the crooked staircase. His seeming adoration gave Jane the creeps. After so long seeking absolute power, he found himself utterly powerless, and was relieved to submit, perhaps as pleased to be the face beneath the boot as he would have been to be the boot, as long as he could remain in the presence of power. She didn't want his veneration, and it wasn't mercy that would prevent her from turning out the lights. Even in his diminished capacity, she simply didn't want to be alone in the dark with him. 25. The previous night, Gilberto had enjoyed 8 hours of sleep, unlike Jane, who had gotten 4 hours. But as he leaned back in his kitchen chair and massaged the nape of his neck with one hand, he looked as tired and world-weary as she felt. She had asked him to impersonate a chauffeur. She regretted that he'd been drawn so much deeper into this. Most of all, she was sorry that he'd been required to witness the enslavement of a fellow human being, even if one so lacking in humanity as this specimen. At 8:45 p.m., and again at 9 o'clock, Jane said to Hendrickson, "Play Manchurian with me," which was the trigger sentence programmed into the earlier generations of control mechanisms, like the one with which he'd been injected. Twice, he sat in silence, head bowed, either lost in thought or in a cataleptic trance that might be the end destination of his psychological collapse. The third time, at 9:20, he lifted his head and said, "All right," and waited, expectantly. Of course, he'd known the trigger sentence and the proper reply before he'd been injected. He could be faking. She had devised a test that involved a sterilized scalpel from the mortuary's instrument collection and a command for Hendrickson to cut one thumb. When the moment came, however, she knew too much about his past suffering to require of him a test of pain. She said, "Are you tired, Booth?"
"Oh, yes."
His ashen face, his bloodshot eyes, his pale lips were those of a man at the limit of his resources. "Are you very tired?" she asked.
"Very. I've never been so tired."
"While we were waiting for the control mechanism to implant, was everything you told me true?"
"Yes."
"Entirely true? Even about Tahoe?"
"Yes. True."
"And now you're very tired. So I'm going to order you to sleep, and keep sleeping until I wake you by touching your right shoulder and saying your name. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Sleep," she said. He slumped in the chair, and his head lolled to one side, and he seemed to sleep. 26. Whether this was her second or third vodka and coke in the past few hours, she didn't know. She didn't care. She wanted only to stop thinking about the crooked staircase, about the terrible task that lay ahead, and be able to get 4 or 5 hours of sleep. In the low light of a silk-shaded lamp, she and Gilberto sat in living room armchairs, facing each other. He had poured for himself a generous portion of scotch, weakened by a single ice cube. Hendrickson remained asleep and tethered to the chair in the kitchen. They had left brighter lights on for him than they wanted for themselves. Minutes earlier, after a call from Gilberto, his older brother, Hector, and Hector's 17-year-old son, Manuel, had stopped by, and Gilberto had gone downstairs to give them a key so they could retrieve Jane's SUV. They knew only that an unnamed friend had left it parked in the lot of a supermarket the previous day and needed it to be brought here. Gilberto swirled the scotch just enough to clink the dwindling ice cube against the glass.
"I thought my war was over years ago."
"It's all one war," she said, "and it's never over. But you have a haven here. Still no reason to be afraid of the dead.
Only the living.
He took a drink.
Long way to Lake Tahoe.
If I catch some sleep, hit the road by 4, I'll be there by noon, maybe 1 o'clock if the weather sucks.
With him riding beside you?
I need him.
But can you really trust him?
Not to turn on me? Yeah. But if his psychological collapse gets any worse than it is now, he might not be as useful as I hope.
They know you have him.
But you hurt him. They don't know I walked away from Napa with samples of the control mechanism.
He didn't know. Maybe others do.
I'm betting they don't. And given the need-to-know rule, they won't notify the couple that maintains the Tahoe house when Annabelle isn't there. Hell, they're just old people. Plebs, plotters, rabble, two-legged cattle. Gilberto shuddered.
What he said about why they make some kill themselves and just enslave others?
Hendrickson's explanation was engraved in Jane's memory.
The ones who would turn society in the wrong direction? We hate them and believe they deserve to die. Some of those we enslave are just for our pleasure, like the girls of Aspasia. Others will run the world at our direction while we remain concealed behind them, and they are all ignorant fools who deserve to be enslaved.
After they took a moment of solace in their drinks, Gilberto said,
"People in power, in my dad's day, they weren't full of contempt for the rest of us."
"Power corrupts?"
"It's something more than that. Power has always corrupted."
"It's all the damn experts," she said. "We stopped governing ourselves, turned it over to experts." He frowned.
"It's a complex world. People running it have to know what they're doing."
"These experts don't have any real-world experience worth shit. They're elitists. They're all theory, but no real-world experience. Self-described intellectuals."
"Well, I guess maybe I know the type. Just turn on the TV."
"This British historian, Paul Johnson, he wrote a great book about them," Jane said. "It'll scare the piss out of you."
"I'm already scared, pretty much pissless."
"They're uber-conformists, live in a bubble of the like-minded, contemptuous of common sense and regular people."
"Plebs, plotters, the great unwashed like us."
"But people matter more than ideas. Nick mattered more than any idiot theory. My boy, your kids, they matter more."
"You see it changing?"
That was a question she had asked herself. The honest answer wasn't comforting. "It's gotten worse for a couple centuries."
"We gotta hope, though."
"Hope," she agreed. "And resist." 27. Carter Jurgen says, with delight,
"Sometimes a charitable act is rewarded with a kick in the teeth."
For weeks, in search of the hidden boy, agents had been tracking down every relative of Nick's and Jane's, even to the ex-spouse of a second cousin. Every former Marine with whom Nick had served, the families of the victims of the serial killers Jane had caught or killed, with the expectation that she might have bonded with one of those families, her old college friends, anyone she might trust with her child, to no avail. Because neither Nick nor Jane was a showboat, their support of organizations serving veterans didn't come to the attention of the searchers until so many other, more likely avenues of inquiry had been exhausted. And suddenly, in the photo collections of the fundraising events of those organizations, there they were, at this marathon, at that wheelchair sports weekend, at this gala, often in the company of Gavin and Jessica Washington, smiling and happy and obviously with friends. As Carter Jurgen pilots the Range Rover between the colonnades of Live Oaks, he says, "No rest for the weary."
"It's the price of success," Radley DuBose replies. "We kicked ass on the Shukla job, so they drop this on us a day later. Doesn't bother me. I like being wanted. You ever think what'll happen if we start screwing up? No Christmas bonus? It'll be you and me getting needles in the arm like we did the Hindu Rider kids.
Not in a million years, says Jurgen, surprised that even as stunted a specimen as Dubose is so cynical.
We don't eat our own.
That statement elicits a patronizing smile.
No cannibalism among the Brahmins. I went to an Ivy League school, remember? I saw what I saw. I know what I know.
Oversized and self-satisfied, Dubose now reminds Jurgen of yet another cartoon character, Popeye.
I saw what I saw. I know what I know. I am what I am.
Not every Ivy Leaguer is an Arcadian, or could be, or should be, Jurgen says.
Certainly not a lot of them at the University of Pennsylvania. It's distressing that Penn's even considered Ivy League.
Being a Harvard man and proud of it, Carter Jurgen is pretty sure he's being mocked with that Penn comment, but now they arrive at the Washington residence. Time to get down to business. The house is a cozy-looking place with a generous front porch. All the lights are on. There's a barn-like building to the left and a stable beyond that, both dark. What most interests Carter Jurgen is the truck that the first responders arrived in, which is parked near the porch steps. It's a Hennessy Velociraptor 6x6, a bespoke version of the four-door Ford F-150 Raptor with new axles, two additional wheels, super tough-looking off-road tires, and a ton of other upgrades. It's black. It's amazing. It's a fabulous truck. Recently, some Arcadians in the NSA and Homeland and elsewhere have been assigned impressive vehicles, mostly bespoke Range Rovers created by Overfinch North America with performance upgrades, a carbon fiber styling package, a dual-valve titanium exhaust system, and other cool stuff. Jurgen has envied the hell out of them.
But this...
this truck is another level of perk altogether. There are two men waiting on the back porch. They're wearing slim-fit ring-jacket suits, which manage to look casual in spite of the exquisite Neapolitan tailoring, and their seven-fold Cesare Attolini ties are in playful, soft polka-dot patterns. Jurgen feels underdressed in a black t-shirt, diesel black-gold denim jacket with embroidered scorpions, and black Dior Homme jeans, but he is, after all, a field op, not a front office guy. Dubose's outfit is unspeakable, suitable for knocking around in small-town West Virginia and not much else. The back door of the house is closed, but Jurgen can hear old music from before his time, a song titled Get a Job. The men on the porch don't give their names. They are brisk, almost brusque. They succinctly lay out the situation. It became known at 4 o'clock p.m. on Friday that Gavin and Jessica Washington were harboring the 5-year-old son of Jane Hawk. A decision was made to establish surveillance of the entrance to their private lane and to monitor the house by remotely opening the mics in their phones, computers, and TVs, as well as with the cameras in their computers and TVs. As their televisions did not have internet links, they proved useless. At 3 o'clock a.m. Saturday, NSA electronic surveillance aircraft out of Los Angeles, rebased to Orange County Airport, began spelling each other over the valley, fishing for all incoming and outgoing burner phone traffic with the hope of identifying a call from Jane Hawk to the Washingtons and using track-to-source to locate her. At 7:20 p.m., after dinner, the Washingtons and the boy agreed to play Old Maid. They accompanied the game with classic doo-wop music. Their conversation was unremarkable, partly obscured by the music. After a while, when they turned up the volume of the iPod, they couldn't be heard talking. It was assumed either that they were speaking softly and the music drowned out their conversation, or that they'd run out of things to say to one another. After a series of quieter tunes, Sincerely by the Moonglows, Earth Angel by the Penguins, and Only You by the Platters, the suspicion arose that the Washingtons and the boy were no longer in the house. An operative was sent on foot from the county road to reconnoiter. He circled the house, peering in windows, subsequently entered, and confirmed that the house was deserted. The deck of old maid cards on the table had not been removed from the box. 4 vehicles are registered to Gavin and Jessica Washington. 3 are currently in the garage. A rebuilt and customized 87 Land Rover is missing, and it apparently has no GPS. A back gate in the ranch fencing, left open, suggests that the 3 became aware of surveillance and fled overland. A team of specialists is en route. On arrival, they will take the house and other buildings apart in search of clues as to Jane Hawk's activities or whereabouts. Meanwhile, Jurgen and DuBose are tasked with pursuing the Washingtons and the boy overland, assisted by an aerial night search helicopter, which is currently incoming. In fact, no sooner has the aerial unit been mentioned than the helo roars overhead, shaking the long branchlets of the live oaks and stirring up whirling masses of dry leaves that chitter like a plague of locusts before it moves off toward the open gate. One of the agents in a ring jacket suit holds a vehicle key, and a thrill passes through Carter Jurgen as he looks at the hulking black Hennessy Velociraptor 6x6. The second agent in a ring jacket suit produces a clipboard, and it is necessary for DuBose and Jurgen to sign one document that relinquishes the Range Rover and a second that acknowledges their possession of the Velociraptor as their new official vehicle.
"On the front seats in the truck," the agent says, "you'll find night vision gear. You have direct voice communication with the helo crew to coordinate the search."
Jurgen makes the mistake of letting DuBose sign the documents first. By the time Jurgen signs them, the backwoods boy has the key. Smiling, he says,
"I'll drive."
28. Gilberto insisted that he keep a watch on Hendrickson, even though the man was now controlled and sleeping in the kitchen chair to which his ankles were zip-tied.
"I'll sleep when you leave. I couldn't sleep anyway with him here. Even before you had to inject him, the guy was a strange piece of work, miswired. Now he's like a zombie or something. Makes my skin crawl."
Hector and his son had brought Jane's Ford Explorer Sport from Newport Coast and parked it alongside the funeral home. Gilberto carried her suitcase to the guest room. Jane was too tired to shower, but she showered anyway because she wanted to be on the road as soon as possible after she woke in the morning. She set the alarm clock for 3 a.m. She switched off the bedside lamp and stretched out and put her head on the pillow. The bedroom lay at the front of the apartment, overlooking the street. The single window featured draperies, but she had neglected to draw them shut. Now she didn't have the energy to cross the room and close them. The faintest glow of street lamps patinated a portion of the ceiling with tarnished silver. In the light of passing vehicles, the skeletal shadow of an ancient sycamore, not yet leafed for spring, swooned across the ceiling and the walls, its direction depending on whether the traffic was racing east or west, toppling again and yet again, each time in silence, into darkness. During the past few months, whether Jane slept fitfully or soundly, she had always dreamed, as though each day was so crammed with events that she needed 24 hours to properly consider the meaning of them, to let the unconscious mind review them and either counsel her with scenarios of reassurance or ring loud its alarms. Now, she dreamed of being on the road, behind the wheel, traveling through a country of the mind with illogical geography. Snow-draped forests of evergreens melting into red rock deserts, cityscapes blurring into lonely shorelines. Nick sat beside her, Travis in the back seat, and sometimes her mother was alive again and sitting at Travis's side, and all was well, until Nick said,
"I think to myself, I play to myself, and nobody knows what I say to myself."
When she looked at him, he wasn't Nick any longer. He was Booth Hendrickson, with eyes closed, sleeping as she had ordered him to sleep, until he turned his head toward her and opened his eyes, which were as pure white as hard-boiled eggs.
"Nobody knows," he repeated.
And he was holding a hypodermic syringe, which he stabbed into her neck. Part 4. Finding Travis. 1. Sans headlights, with the dashboard instruments fully dimmed, Radley DuBose drives the big 800-horsepower Velociraptor into the glowing green night. Also wearing night vision goggles, Carter Jurgen rides shotgun, faking an enthusiasm for the position that he doesn't feel. Venting his frustration would achieve nothing except give pleasure to the West Virginia vulgarian. Although daylight might better facilitate the search, they are able to detect signs of the Land Rover's passage. A length of tire tracks through softer earth, a swath of broken weeds the width of a vehicle. Here, parallel lines of crushed grass, and here, chunks of sod torn out where tires briefly spun for purchase. The problem is that no uninterrupted trail of spoor exists. The signs are scattered along the route the Washingtons have taken, but between them are long stretches of hard and barren land, where only a legendary Indian scout of another century might be able to discern evidence of their passage. It is easy to misread a spoor and turn in the wrong direction, vainly seeking another tire track. Which is where the night search helicopter comes in handy. With both look-down and look-ahead night vision cameras that display on the advanced glass cockpit, the co-pilot is able to scan for traces of the Land Rover's progress, zoom in, as mere goggles can't, and capture even subtle telltales. In addition to its night vision cameras, the chopper has the ability to sweep the terrain below for infrared sources, which also display on the cockpit glass. Because the day had been merely warm, because an overcast had formed during the afternoon, and because nightfall is hours behind them, the land has given up most of its stored heat. It does not present a bright, distracting background to the co-pilot. The heat signatures of coyotes are easy to distinguish from those of deer, and those of deer from those of any human being on foot. If the helicopter gets close enough to scan the Land Rover, the vehicle's heat signature will be a blazing beacon in this otherwise untraveled wilderness. Both the Hilo and the Velociraptor are equipped with special FM receivers and transmitters operating below the standard commercial band occupied by radio stations, tuned to an unused spot on the dial. In addition to his night vision headgear, Carter Jurgen wears an earbud on which he receives guidance from the crew of the Hilo, and he passes this along to DuBose. His role is important, but it doesn't compensate for being aced out of the driver's seat. He consoles himself with the knowledge that if they get this right, they will be heroes of the Arcadian Revolution forever. They will rise high in the ranks to positions of greater privilege, even if only one of them deserves to be rewarded. He and DuBose must try to avoid killing the Washingtons, so that the husband and wife can be injected, controlled, and questioned as to everything they know about the hawk bitch and about who else might have been helping her. Her precious cub, Travis, will become their hostage, and Mama Bear will be given damn little time to surrender or else be responsible for his suffering. 100 yards ahead of them, the Hilo hovers, identified by an illegal minimum of running lights that register as 3 small points of green fire, as well as by a pale haze produced by the luminous displays of its night vision cameras on its cockpit glass. Nothing of its real shape can be perceived, so that the imagination can make of it a levitating sphere or even a saucer-shaped vessel. If Jurgen didn't know what lay before him, he might be persuaded that it is a ship from another world. The co-pilot of the Hilo reports, "Disturbance patterns in an otherwise uniform slope of scree. Could be from a vehicle." "We'll check it out," Jurgen replies. When he turns to DuBose and passes on the message, the big man's face is green and, in Jurgen's judgment, brutish, even a bit Neanderthaloid, and he is reminded of another comic book figure, the Hulk.
"This light really messes with your head," DuBose says. "I feel as if I've fallen inside the virtual reality of a video game, one of those early ones where the VR wasn't as realistic as it is these days. It's eerie, isn't it?
obscure and lonely, haunted by ill angels only.
Jurgen recognizes the reference to Poe. He is unsettled by the entire character of Dubose's little speech, because it does not seem to be anything someone of his rustic bloodline would say, even after an education at Princeton, if education is the right word for what that institution confers on its students. They speed across a largely barren area where the scattered clump grass struggles for existence and is so twisted and ragged from winds of other days that whatever damage even the velociraptor does to this flora could not be taken as signs of its passage. They come to a short declining slope and a wide swale, beyond which lies a long upward grade. While the helo hovers 100 feet overhead, Dubose drives down and stops in the shallow trough. Through the windshield, Jurgen can just barely make out where the ghostly rising slope of gravelstone has been disturbed, although nothing as clearly defined as tire tracks can be seen. He is grateful to have a reason to take off his night vision goggles and get out of the velociraptor before Dubose might quote another poet and thereby require a complete reassessment of his nature and his mental capacity. The downdraft from a rotary wing of the chopper tosses Jurgen's hair and flutters the collar points of the diesel black gold denim jacket against his throat, as if the embroidered scorpions have come alive and crawled up from his chest. He carries an LED flashlight with which he sweeps the slope ahead. It is a broad expanse of deep scree that time and weather have combed into an even texture, except for a 9 or 10 foot wide section that appears to have been disturbed by something. A small seismic event would likely have affected the entire face of the slope, so this might in fact be the work of the Land Rover. Bent forward, studying the mass of small stones, he works his way up the slope with some effort, the scree shifting treacherously underfoot. The rhythmic whoomp, whoomp, whoomp of the helo timed like an amplification of his heart's systole. At about the halfway point, something glistens in the beam of the flashlight, a brownish-black glob. He wipes up a bit of it with his forefinger, studies the stuff, smells it. Axle grease. 2. The coyotes lost interest in the Land Rover, whitting away into the moonless dark on the track of some irresistible scent. In this part of California, it was possible to proceed in a twisting route through contiguous stretches of unincorporated scrubland, protected state wildernesses, national forests, and national monuments, skirting even the smallest population centers, passing under little-traveled county and state roads that bridged the canyons, all the way to the Mexican border, where they could leave the U.S. discreetly, either at Tecate or Calexico, Mexicali. Alternately, because the rover had a spare fuel tank, they could venture overland into southern Arizona. However, it wasn't Gavin's intention to spend the entire night off-road or to leave California. In consultation with Jane, he and Jesse had developed a plan in anticipation of a day when they might have to go on the run for a while until this Arcadian conspiracy was blown up, which it would be, because it must be. Considering that they were fleeing from a murderous cabal and might be leaving their comfortable life behind forever, he felt surprisingly confident. Not light-hearted, not full of breezy good cheer. He was buoyed by the kind of sober-minded high spirits that warriors knew after a successful operation, an exhilaration tempered by being well acquainted with death. He'd survived numerous near-death moments in Afghanistan, and Jesse had survived 2 helicopters being shot down and an IED detonating directly under her Jeep. When you miraculously escaped mortal threats often enough, changes occurred in your thinking. For one thing, you came to believe in miracles, although it was better not to expect them routinely. For another thing, you began to wonder if just maybe there was a scheme to things, and if perhaps your sorry ass had been saved for a purpose. When Jane showed up on their doorstep, needing a place in which to hide Travis, Gavin had at once thought, "This is it. The very reason why my sorry ass is still on the planet." He had looked at Jessica, and her smile had confirmed that she'd arrived at the same conviction. She was the one who had said yes, by saying, "As long as this boy's here with us, the worst thing that'll happen to him is maybe he'll stub a toe." Saying such a thing was tempting fate, but it was the kind of bravado that Jane had needed to hear. Now, the time had come either to make good on that promise or die trying. The first leg of their journey required them to cross out of Orange County into San Diego County, far from where they had ridden horses earlier in the day, and pick up State Highway 76 east of Pala. The overland part of the journey was 25 miles if you drew a straight line between points, but the rough terrain didn't permit direct travel. In fact, they might have to go as far as 50 miles, and there were stretches of ground over which they could not attain any significant speed, especially because of the need to avoid using headlights. Gavin hoped to reach Highway 76 by midnight, a little more than 4 hours after setting out. He expected to be pursued. The only question was how much of a head start they might get. Jesse was certain, Gavin had to agree, there would be an aerial component to the search team, which meant the pursuer would make faster progress than the pursued. Consequently, he stopped periodically and switched off the engine and got out of the Land Rover to listen to the night and scan the land behind them through the NVGs. He needed to guard against the posse abruptly coming upon them without their knowledge. The third time, when he parked at the head of a long decline, there were the usual desert insect buzzes and clicks and busy ticks, also feline cries that might have been a family of bobcats on the hunt, and from a distance, the distinctive sound of a helicopter. He surveyed the night to the northwest, the direction from which they had come. At first, nothing, just a green dark. Then, he identified a 3-point constellation in the totally overcast sky, brighter than any stars would have been, each as brilliant as Venus. The constellation rotated. Not stars. A minimal array of aircraft running lights. They were closer than he expected. He needed to take the Land Rover to lower ground at once and proceed only through valleys and canyons, as deep below the rolling hilltops as he could get, where the engine heat would not register on the helo's look-ahead cameras. When he got in behind the wheel and started the engine, Jesse asked, "Has the shit hit the fan?"
"Not yet, but they're flinging it our direction."
Jesse looked over her left shoulder.
"Are you belted in back there, cowboy?"
"Belted," Travis assured her. "And the dogs are down, like they're supposed to be."
Because of the noise made by the chopper, the pursuing ground unit wouldn't be able to listen for the Land Rover. Gavin goosed the engine, and they sped down the long slope with stones rattling hard against the undercarriage and quick-settling dust billowing out behind them. He had to stay as much as possible on sandstone and mudstone and slopes of talus, away from soft soil, avoiding any vegetation that would betray their passage, until he found a place to go to ground. He didn't think he could reach the state route across the county line before they came upon him. His best chance might be to tuck the rover away somewhere, lie low, and hope that the helo would pass over them, fruitlessly quartering the wilds in search of their human game. But when you had a vehicle with a hot engine, where did you hide it from an infrared search in a night-cooled landscape as barren as this one?
3. In the kitchen, Gilberto didn't need black coffee or caffeine tablets or lively music to stay awake. In the chair directly across the dinette table from him, Booth Hendrickson was the perfect cure for drowsiness. Jane had ordered the man to sleep, and he slept, but his sleep was dream-riddled and never restful. Behind his pale lids, his eyes moved ceaselessly, fixing on whatever sights in some dark nightmare kingdom. His face was not slack, but enlivened by expressions ranging from perplexion to abhorrence to revulsion. When he wasn't grinding his teeth or chewing his lips, he made soft, pathetic sounds or talked in his sleep, his voice haunting the kitchen as if it issued from another dimension.
Hands and hands and more hands, 1,000 hands.
Because he was restrained by zip ties linking his ankles to the stretcher bar between the back legs of his chair, his hands remained free. As he spoke, they crawled upon the table, nervous, uncertain, this way and that, as if he were seeking something that he feared finding.
"Don't make me! Don't make me! Don't make me!" he pleaded in a whisper.
His respiration grew ragged and then panicky as he gasped for breath and exhaled in gusts, making thin sounds of desperation, as if some creature born of hell pursued him. It seemed that he must wake himself, but each time the panic subsided, and still he slept, sliding into a less urgent state of anxiety. From time to time, he returned to the subject of eyes.
"Their eyes! Their eyes!" And later, "What's that in their eyes? Do you see? Do you see what's in their eyes?"
Although Gilberto didn't need caffeine, he wanted something to settle his stomach. The scotch he'd drunk had soured in his gut and acid refluxed on him. He brought a glass of cold milk to the table and used it to chase a tablet of Pepcid AC before he sat down again.
"Don't leave me in the dark," Hendrickson pleaded in an urgent and despairing whisper. "No way is the way you think it is. There's no out, only in."
For a few minutes the man was silent, though his face appeared no less tortured. Abruptly, he opened his eyes and sat forward in his chair and seemed to look at Gilberto as he whispered,
"Heads inside heads, eyes inside eyes. They're coming now. I know they're coming. No way to keep them out of my eyes, out of my head. They're coming."
"What can I do for you?" Gilberto asked. "Can I help you somehow?"
But maybe Hendrickson didn't see him after all, hadn't been speaking to him, and was still asleep even when his eyes were open. He closed them and settled back in his chair and grew quiet again. Gilberto doubted that the milk and acid reducer were going to work. 4. Radley DuBose becomes increasingly agitated as 40 minutes pass with no sign of further spoor left by their quarry. He curses the Washingtons, the night, the desert, the helicopter, its pilot, and its co-pilot. Even though he gets to drive a velociraptor with all the features that Hennessy's Wizards of Customization can provide, a truck costing north of $300,000, he is not happy. He is possessed by a backwoods urge to whoop somebody, anybody. Carter Jurgen is also frustrated, though he would be much less so if he were behind the wheel instead of stuck in the passenger's seat, relaying messages from the Hilo co-pilot, who for 40 minutes has not had any news worth passing along. It's almost as if the Land Rover has gone airborne. In the green dark, the Hilo quarters west to east, east to west, while moving steadily southward. If they don't find something in the next 15 minutes or so, they'll have to retreat northward through territory already searched to be sure they haven't missed anything. This scrub desert is not arid all year long, not in its every contour, especially not here, at the end of the rainy season. They arrive at the brink of a deeper canyon than any they have thus far searched. About 200 feet below, a wide, fast-moving stream, born of snowmelt in the distant mountains and swelled by rain in the foothills, slips over such a smooth course that it appears to flow without cataracts or counterflux. Above, the dark green water spread lighter green shapes of mature trees that form cloisters in which sections of the stream disappear, and this side of the trees is the still paler green of the rocky canyon floor. Jurgen and DuBose wait in the velociraptor at the edge of the canyon and watch as the helicopter slowly quarters more than a mile to the east. Then it moves back toward them, past them, before hovering above the stream at a point at least 0.5 mile to the west of their position. The co-pilot reports,
"We have a heat source under the tree cover. No clear profile. Diffused heat. Might not be them."
When Jurgen repeats this message, DuBose says,
"Damn right it's them. Parked in the running water, engine off, hoping the rover will cool down so the trees can fully screen it.
The canyon wall is without vegetation and not an easy slope, steeper in some places than in others.